Dámy a pánové, vážení přítomní, jak jste si zajisté všimli, dialog právě začal. Já jsem vás pozval na toto setkání a jsem vám velmi vděčen všem, že jste toto pozvání přijali, že jste přišli. Vidím tu společnost nesmírně různorodou, od představitelů různých států, národních bank, přes soukromý sektor až po představitele nevládních organizací. Nejsem si jist, zda během tohoto setkání vyřešíme všechny gigantické problémy tohoto světa, ale pakliže se nám podaří aspoň navázat rozhovor, byť by to byl rozhovor mezi lidmi, kteří se těžko kdy na něčem zhodnou, bylo by i to dobré. A to je smyslem tohoto setkání. Teď bude panelová diskuze. Já velmi děkuji hostům, kteří přijali účast v tomto panelu a speciálně Mary Robinsonové, mé přítelkyni, která se ujala moderování té diskuze. A potom asi po hodinové rozpravě, které se, doufám, i vy účastníte, bude procházka královskou zahradou. Ještě jednou děkuji, že jste přišli.
Mr. President, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I welcome President Havel's initiative of creating this space for dialogue on the occasion of the annual meeting of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The idea of bringing so many people together today, covering a whole range of views and sharply differing viewpoints, is what I would expect from someone of President Havel's courage and vision. Holding this meeting is itself a positive step in that it brings in civil society and lets its voice be heard. It shows that international economic policy issues are relevant to all of us, not just to the economic specialists. It recognizes, too, the depth of concern that exists about the impact of globalization. I'm honored to have been asked to chair this panel, and I warmly welcome and will very briefly introduce the participants. I will begin on my left and introduce Anne Pettifor, who is the... Sorry, this is my right. And introduce Anne Pettifor, who is co-founder of the International Jubilee 2000 movement. And on her right is James Wolfensohn, president of the World Bank. And on his right, Walden Bellow, the distinguished thinker, writer, and activist. And perhaps appropriately on my left is Katerina Liškova, who is co-founder of the Czech Independent Socially Ecologic Movement. And on her left is Horst Köhler, the Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund. On his left, the Minister of Finance of the Republic of South Africa, Trevor Manuel. And furthest to the left on this occasion, Mr. George Soros, the international financier and philanthropist. The title for our meeting is The Main Problems of Contemporary Civilization, including the responsibility of mankind for the development of the poorest regions of the world. That's certainly a broad area and one which could take more than 90 minutes to address. The sub-themes perhaps point us better in the direction that we should take. They are the role of the international institutions, that is, the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, etc., and specifically the question of debt cancellation. Secondly, the role of civil society, especially non-governmental organizations, in the developed and the developing countries. Thirdly, economic globalization and the possibilities of its regulation. And fourthly, development of the world's poorest regions versus human rights and environmental policy. I want to explain very briefly the format of our meeting. We have had a good discussion, and the format that I had in mind has been altered. So democracy has already been working. Because this is a dialogue that brings those who have been out on the street, giving us a wake-up call, an opportunity to come in and to have their voice heard, I'm going to begin by calling on the three representatives of a broader civil society. And then, when we have heard their presentations, I will put questions to the other three panelists, and then the panelists will engage with each other, and I will try to moderate and be fair. But if I may, I'd like to just say a few words myself to start things off. Globalization is not a new phenomenon, but the scale and the speed of it and the expansion of it so rapidly is. Partly this is due to a technological revolution which we're experiencing, but part has to do with policy decisions where we have choices. What we've witnessed in recent times is a rising level of concern among ordinary people about the impact of globalization, the direction the international economic order seems to be taking, and the role of the Bretton Woods institutions. These are legitimate, indeed vital issues, and they need to be addressed, not only by the world leaders, but by all of us, which is why this dialogue is so important. In a way, the protesters in Seattle and elsewhere were ahead of the world's leaders in identifying the scale of the problem before they did. I would say that it's time to link the debate in the street with the debate taking place in so many other contexts. Globalization and the international economic order are firmly at the top of the agenda. Now comes the hard part of sitting down and trying to work out how to improve the situation. All of us have a big stake in this. That's probably what we share in common. It would be wrong to be blind to the economic benefits that globalization has brought to some. To give just one example, the information and communications revolution, which is one of the many facets of globalization, has expanded our horizons greatly. The problem is that only some are benefiting. You're all familiar with the statistics. I only want to mention two, which I think are worth mentioning here. The fact that all of Africa accounts for only 0.3% of world trade. And in terms of the digital divide, there are 30 personal computers for every 100 people in Britain, whereas in Malawi, there is only one for every 10,000 people. I believe it would be wrong to imagine that we can turn the clock back on globalization. The real question I see is, how can we humanize globalization? How can we have a policy impact that shapes globalization? How can we shape it in such a way that it can benefit all instead of some? I'd like to suggest one way in which I believe that the situation could be improved, or, to put it another way, I would point to one big gap in the present situation. If we look at how the international order is regulated, we see that there are a number of different sets of rules. There are international environmental laws that seek to address the problems affecting our planet's climate. There are the WTO rules that govern trade. The Bretton Woods institutions were set up to bring order to international financial affairs. And there are the international human rights norms and standards developed over the past 50 years. What is striking is that these different sets of rules operate independently, in parallel lines, as it were. There's very little overlap. Few people are bilingual or multilingual when it comes to these different sets of rules. Yet it seems to me that we must find ways of improving communications and indeed cross-referencing between these sets of rules if we're to put a human face on globalization. The market has been the driving force behind globalization, but as we all know, there's more to life than the market. The fight against poverty is an example. I regard tackling poverty and exclusion as the greatest challenge of our time. It won't surprise you if I say that I believe the best way to address these problems is through a human rights-based approach. What we call a rights-based approach, but I put in the word human to make it clear that it is a whole approach that can be adopted. Put simply, this means taking account of the international human rights treaties which most governments have signed up to and making them part of economic policy, financial interaction, and the role of civil society. Obviously, I could go on. We could all go on this subject. But as moderator, I have a pleasure now in opening to my distinguished panel. And I'm going to first ask Katharina Lyshkova to present a short, well-thought-out presentation on behalf of herself and many others, she tells me. Katharina.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen. Sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, we are not sitting here with the summit representatives of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund so that we can give them a friendly handshake and pat on the back. They would like to take the chance to convince us and you of their dreams of a world without poverty. However, the reality is that almost 3 billion people today live on less than $2 a day. Since the year 1944, when the IMF and the World Bank were established, the income gap between the rich and poor has increased by more than 6 times. And that is not despite the efforts of both of these development agencies, but because of them. It is also their fault. It is precisely the World Bank and IMF who, through their development projects, helped to destroy the environment, curtail human rights and social security, and intensify poverty in the countries of the Third World. The evidence of this is extensive, but unfortunately we do not have space right now for detailed elaboration. We consider the termination of the Bretton Woods institutions and the cancelling of the debt of poor countries to be the primary essential condition for the satisfactory solution of the problem of world poverty. The changes which the policymakers of the World Bank and IMF have permitted under the pressure of international public are merely cosmetic. There continues to be an absence of political control which makes it possible for undemocratic regimes to borrow money for megalomaniac projects. The result of this lack of political responsibility on the part of these institutions is thus the insufficient provision of information to the public. According to the current policy, it is possible to keep almost all significant information secret until the loan is approved. The public thus loses the possibility to effectively intervene in the process of project approval. It is therefore no surprise that so far the World Bank poverty reduction project have been the least successful of any projects that the bank has undertaken. Considering the assumptions that the bank bases its decisions on, it is not possible to expect improvement in the future. If the post-war reconstruction of Western Europe had run according to World Bank prescriptions, we would still be living with food rationing today. However, the termination of the bank and fund will not in and of itself resolve the situation. In order for poverty to be truly effectively solved, it is necessary to attempt a change in the political economic system, a change in the system which makes it possible for the few to turn millions of people into beggars at the push of a button, a change in the system in which a person who is attached to his own locality is at a tragic disadvantage against a multinational giant that doesn't know the meaning of home. The continually escalating worldwide protest movement aimed at both of the Bretton Woods institutions is a completely natural reaction of people in a situation where their demands are overlooked and refused. It is a reaction to the state of the world in which small groups of oligarchs, responsible to no one, decide practically beyond our control about affairs of far-reaching significance. But the protests of millions of people in poor countries, provided their political regime permits dissent, demonstrate that even those whom the World Bank and similar institutions are so noisily attempting to help would rather refuse that assistance due to their management tactics. On the other hand, corrupted power elites, together with multinational corporations, are still glad to accept this development aid, since the profits of these projects end up right in their own pocket. It is therefore necessary to establish a movement of global solidarity against the multinational concerns and power elites represented by institutions like the IMF and World Bank, which are the engine of the continually accelerating process of economic globalization. That is why there are thousands of people from all around the world coming to Prague now to express their justified exasperation over the fact that the basic decisions about their lives are further and further out of their control. The decision-making mechanisms of these institutions, in the style deciding about us without us, are fundamentally completely undemocratic and remain unaffected by standard attempts at negotiation. Therefore, there is often nothing left to do but proceed with street protest and, sometimes, with non-violent forms of civil disobedience. After all, what is at stake here is the right of every individual to have his or her voice heard and considered where fundamental decisions influencing his or her life are concerned. At the same time, it is completely legitimate for those of us who are emphatically opposed to IMF and World Bank policies to refuse to negotiate with these institutions. For 55 years, these institutions have proven that dialogue with their critics only served the purpose of an adroit publicity strategy behind which there is no attempt at a fundamental change for the better. This simply confirms our conviction that these institutions, as a basic operational principle, cannot be reformed. We therefore demand their termination. We consider the attempts of several public officials to a priori criminalize this position of ours as very dangerous. We do not agree with the division of critics into worthy critics and evil ones, through which all other critics are prevented from fulfilling their right to freedom of speech, which is guaranteed by international covenant. It is shameful when their demonstrations are forbidden, and if they take place, it is within the reach of water cannons and tear gas, and in the sights of snipers. Where is the declared willingness to participate in dialogue if hundreds of protesters are held behind the iron curtain of the Czech Republic's border, while others are harassed by police in the streets only for their appearance and opinion, or are followed by the secret police? Despite these repressive measures, the slogans "enough already" and 55 years is enough will be heard in many languages from around the world on the streets of Prague. And they will also be heard from the mouth of a number of those who are sitting in this hall today.
Thank you, Katarina. I think the voice of the many in the street has been well heard. I'm now going to call on Walden Bello, and I still emphasize that we will have and intend to have dialogue, but I think it's important that we hear enough of voices that we don't hear enough in forums like this first, and then we will have the exchange and dialogue. So, Walden Bellow, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank President Havel for organizing this discussion that I would much prefer to say debate. Thank you also, President Robinson. Let me say, in compressing this in 67 minutes, begin on our observation that I never thought that I'd be seated so closely to Jim Wolfensohn of the World Bank. I think this is what is called a combat of close quarters. Now, why is this debate critical? Because I think what President Havel has provided is an opportunity for real engagements rather than rhetoric and monologue. And I hope that indeed this will be a situation of real debate. A few years ago, indeed, even just 1 or 2 years ago, this would not have been possible. I think a real debate with NGOs would not have been accepted by Mr. Wolfensohn and by Mr. Kohler. Why are these two gentlemen here today? Because the legitimacy of the World Bank and the IMF, along with the World Trade Organization, is at its lowest point in the last 55 years. They can no longer engage in a strategy of denial that nothing's going wrong. Indeed, they must now at least try to at least have the form of listening to us. Let me say that I would just like to say that we can approach this by looking at some myths and what are the facts. A, that the IMF and the World Bank are concerned about good governance. Indeed, the writings of Mr. Wolfensohn makes one's heart bleed about good governance. The reality is that in the last 30 years, the World Bank and the IMF have been the central supporters of dictatorships and corrupt governments in the Third World. You cannot just say in the last 2 years, no more. The record is clear. We have seen this with Marcos in the Philippines, with the military dictatorships in Latin America, with Chile under Pinochet, the pre-government in Mexico, and, of course, Indonesia. These were all countries of concentration of the World Bank. Let me just say that one of the most egregious cases of this is the way the World Bank poured $30 billion in support of Mr. Suharto and his regime. What happened is that, as admitted by World Bank internal papers, the World Bank tolerated corruption. It helped legitimize false statistics. It helped legitimize the dictatorship that it tried to pose as a model. And it created a complacency about the state of human rights and the economy. Yes, Mr. Wolfensohn, under your watch, in the last several years, you helped legitimize Mr. Suharto's dictatorship, and that is something that the people of the world will never forgive the World Bank for, particularly the people of Indonesia. B. The World Bank and the IMF are sensitive to environmental issues. Come on. Structural adjustment programs by the fund and the bank have been proven by study after study to be among the principal drivers of environmental destruction in the Third World because of the way they institutionalize stagnation, poverty, and rapid income inequality. The Chad-Cameroon pipeline, a terrible project in terms of environmental grounds, Mr. Wolfensohn continues to push for the approval of this. And just a few months ago, the World Bank violated its own policies by pushing for the approval of the China Western Poverty Program, which would have indeed resettled people from China in this area, very fragile area, that would have dislocated many of the people there who were of Tibetan stock. The record shows that indeed the situation of environmental lending in the bank is getting even more marginal. The environmental staff of the World Bank is, in fact, quite marginal. And this was shown by the resignation of the prime ecological economist of the world from the World Bank, Herman Daly, because he told us, my work was not being listened to. Third, the bank concerned with poverty, and the IMF concerned with poverty. The IMF and the World Bank have been among the greatest creators of poverty. Structural adjustment programs that have been pushed over the last 20 years on 93rd world and Eastern European countries have consolidated stagnation in these economies. There have been so few, indeed there were hardly any successes of structural adjustment, that the IMF, like a whipped dog, changed the name of the extended structural adjustment facility to the Poverty Reduction and Growth Facility, because nobody could stomach anymore the fact that its claims that it was bringing about prosperity, there was hardly anything to support this. The IMF indeed has been in the process of creating poverty in East Asia with the way that it pushed these programs of adjustment on the Asian economies, and these have created tremendous dislocations and unemployment because of their stagnationist thrusts. Again, Indonesia is a case in point. 40% of the Indonesian workforce is now unemployed or underemployed. 40% are now living in poverty. And I think there is now a consensus that the IMF's program after the Asian financial crisis, in fact, threw those economies into a tailspin. The World Bank, all you need to do is to read the Meltzer Commission. This is the bipartisan commission in the United States of the U.S. Congress that basically said that the World Bank is irrelevant to the question of resolving poverty. 80% of the funds of the bank's resources, in fact, does not go to the poor countries, but those with good credit ratings among those countries. 65 to 70%.
Could I ask you to just make your last point? Thank you.
My last point here, and I will just be very brief here, is that when we talk about working with civil society, I think we really need to have real dialogue and openness here. Mr. Wolfenson, instead of working with civil society, as he claims, has just called civil society organizations what he called the Berkeley Mafia. This are people who have been protesting environmental destruction by the bank. In conclusion, let me just say this, Mrs. Robinson. Is the bank and the fund capable of reform? We've been trying for reform over the last 40 to 50 years. It does not work. Whenever projects have been stopped, it has been because of the actions of non-governmental organizations and people on the streets, whether it's the Narmada Dam, the Pakmun Dam, all these different projects, that this has been because of militants and not sweet dialogue. So I would say, therefore, let us really have a debate and open this up rather than be lulled by rhetoric, including rhetoric that says that the World Bank is doing the work of God. Because when it comes to that, then it is something fairly serious in clinical terms. Thank you.
Thank you, Walden Bellow. I'm now going to invite Anne Pettifor to make a brief presentation, and then there will be more of a dialogue in response to the presentations that we've heard. Anne?
Thank you very much, President Robinson. I'd like to begin by thanking the President, President Havel, for the generosity of his invitation and for the graciousness of both his and his country's hospitality while we have been here, but also for the courage of his vision in bringing this together. And it reflects the courage of his life, and we very much appreciate that. Now, I'm very struck by the fact that there is an empty chair over there. If you just overlook, there's a chair over there, and it's empty. And that's where the most important actor, it seems to me, ought to be sitting. What we have at this table are actors from civil society. What we have are actors from the multilateral institutions and from government. But from a developing country government, Trevor, I hope you don't mind me calling South Africa a country from the south, at least. What is absent, who is absent, is the G7. And I want to begin by saying that in Jubilee 2000, we know who the bad guys are. And it's very striking to me that while we are all gathered here feverishly discussing these major issues, the elected politicians who are on the boards of the World Bank and the IMF, and who are the real power mongers in this game, are somewhere else behind closed doors, carving up deals which will not include debt cancellation for the poorest countries. Now, I want to make that very clear, because our view is that while Mr. Wolfensohn may call himself a president, he is just a civil servant. And that is also true of Mr. Kohler, and I say this with no disrespect whatsoever, although he tells me... He tells me he has fanfares playing before his board meetings. But with absolutely no disrespect, I want to say that these people are civil servants and they carry out the decisions of our elected politicians. And we as civil society must not go, in my view, for the soft targets. We must go for the tough targets, who are our finance ministers and our leaders. And I say this because I'm hugely critical of the bank and the fund, but I know, for example, that there was a lot of unease in the fund when billions of dollars were lent to Mr. Yeltsin and then subsequently siphoned off to Cyprus or New York or wherever they were siphoned off from. And I know that those decisions were made as largely as a result of political pressure. So I feel it's important for us to get this into perspective and to invite those who have vacated the chair to come and join the table and the debate. Having said that, I am very clear that the civil servants at the bank and the fund are sustaining that which is unsustainable. These economic policies are not sustainable. It is not possible for countries which are effectively bankrupt to constantly be financing their debts. They cannot do it. They are bankrupt. And the thing that angers us is that the bank and the fund, if you like, operate a little bit like Soviet banks and Soviet institutions. They lecture everybody about market forces. They go further. If a country is highly indebted, they impose market forces on those countries. But they themselves are not accountable to the market, and they are not accountable to taxpayers. And taxpayers, I am told, OECD taxpayers have contributed something like $16 billion to the multilateral institutions in the last year for which I have figures, which is 1998. We know, for example, that Sierra Leone, which is bankrupt, has just taken £10 million of British taxpayers' money, which was intended by taxpayers to be used in Sierra Leone to help the poor people build houses, dig water wells, have some hospitalization, and instead it has gone out of the British Treasury and straight to Washington into the coffers of the IMF and the World Bank. Taxpayers' money is being used to sustain the unsustainable. And we call on the civil servants of the bank and the fund to explain to their political masters that this is unsustainable and has to be brought to an end. And I want to end by saying that there's one thing that Mr. Kohler and Mr. Wolfensohn can do this week. And I call on Mr. Kohler in particular. This is his first fund meeting. This is the meeting at which you can break new ground. This is the meeting in which you can act brutally to change, to reform, and to transform Because after this, it becomes more difficult for you as you become more and more entrenched in the bureaucracy. And I think Mr. Wolfenson might attest to that. This is the meeting. This is the meeting, Mr. Kohler, in which you could make a statement, in which you could persuade your board that they don't need to implement the very, very complicated HIPIC initiative that you have devised for the poor countries. They don't have to implement that. You could persuade your board that they have got massive reserves and they have massive capacity to write off the minuscule debt of the poorest countries, and to do that, to write off 100% of it. We know that you're only planning to write off 30% of that debt. We think it is unfair. We want you to have a new deal this week, Mr. Kohler, not just for the poorest countries, but also for countries like Nigeria. We want you to present to your boards proposals which are manageable and that are sustainable and that we can fight for politically in our own countries. I'm afraid that if you do not do this, if you carry on being the defences for the G7, standing up in front while the G7 are shadowy figures behind you, then you will continue to be attacked in the way that you're going to be attacked this week. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne Pettifor. And now I'm going to turn to the other members of our panel while I facilitate World Bank and IMF by having a little more time to think of all the responses they would wish to make. I'm going to call on Minister Trevor Emmanuel, the Minister of Finance of South Africa, to respond, and perhaps to respond, obviously, to some of the issues that have been raised already. I wouldn't mind if he were to focus on his perception of the role of the G7. Are they the baddies? Also, what steps is South Africa taking to bridge the digital divide, and is there enough support? I'd like you to address those as well as some of the issues that have come up.
Thank you, President Robinson. May I also join my fellow panelists in expressing appreciation both to you and President Hafa for having convened this discussion, debate here this morning. I speak from the perspective of a country that struggled hard to win democracy. And so we attach a lot of weight to the sovereignty hard-earned in hard struggle as a product of very hard sacrifice. And that for us is exceedingly important in the mandate that we take from the people in governance. It also is responsible in the platform that we take in relation to the Bretton Woods Institution in what we ask for and how we engage. In respect of our people, clearly the issues of governance are big issues. They're very different because they also require that we have to take on the responsibility to see issues through. And so in much the same way as Katerina raises that very important slogan, discussions about us, without us, I think as Africans we would also ask all of the NGOs to recognize that they are Africans who need to be included, who have needs and responsibilities, and we need to take account of those issues as we proceed. I think that one of the issues that I would like to focus on is this call for the disbandment of the Bretton Woods institutions. Go back to July of 1944, go back to that important conference in Bretton Woods and recognize the need for three institutions as part of global economic management. The one on trade came much later, but in respect of the two others, I think that there probably is a stronger case for these institutions now. To ask that these institutions be shut down is to ask that the poor be abandoned to their own devices. Because President Robinson, on the African continent, there are three countries that have access to capital markets. All of the other countries and all of their peoples are dependent only on the Bretton Woods institutions poor access to finance. And if those institutions aren't there, then we ask of those countries to run balanced budgets, and that is asking the impossible. So it's dooming the poor to deeper poverty. And so, against that backdrop, we have to focus on what is wrong about these institutions. And I think it's in that context that internal governance does become an issue. And in that context, I find myself agreeing in large part with what Anne had said. Because many of our countries would do what we can because we recognize that we have a responsibility not only to our sovereign peoples, but certainly as Africans, we have a responsibility to other people. We're one of the countries on the African continent that is a donor to AIDA. We are also a contributor to the African Development Fund run by the African Development Bank. But we do so as a poor country. We do so to signal that we need to take responsibility, because part of that responsibility is also to recognize that it's not just about what other people raise about us. We should be taking responsibility. The issues that Waldo raises about corruption and so on are real issues. But it's not for the bank and the fund to raise this. It's not for Bretton Woods to raise these as conditionalities. We as Africans must begin to take responsibility for governance. We have to root out corruption. We must take the responsibility. We must ensure that the resources can get to where they need to be, and we must take full responsibility for our own destiny. It's not for the G7 or others to decide about us. And so our platform for engagement has to be within the Bretton Woods institutions, raising these issues, because if we don't, nobody else will. In respect of the digital divide, clearly it's a big issue. It's big because we sometimes lose a sense of perspective. We forget that the island of Manhattan has as many telephone lines as those serving the 700 million people on the African continent. We sometimes don't realize that the digital divide can be used to leapfrog so many of our people into a different world, because we can't afford all of these institutions of learning steeped in history. We can't afford to pay professors. Our best professors serve the developed world. And so we need to use technology and other means to try and reach our people, change notions of distance learning, change notions of engagement, create opportunities. But that too asks of us to try and sometimes chase the unreachable, and that is investment. We have low savings. The transfers from our countries are huge, both in respect of dividend flows and also in debt servicing. These present themselves as real problems. Unless we raise the problems and try and attend to them, I think we will be failing the next generation. And the big crisis right now is poverty and inequality. It has to be seen by all of us as a crisis larger than the crisis in financial architecture was seen just 2 years ago. And if we focus our minds on that, we will be able to place on the table what is wrong with the world today and put our heads together and address that, because that is the challenge that beckons. I thank you.
Thank you, Minister. I do feel that a very small point of clarification of protocol is called for. When you cease to be president in Ireland, that's it. You are no longer called president, so I'm slightly uncomfortable about being called president. But I do have pleasure in calling on President Jim Wolfensohn of the World Bank. I know that actually he has a lot of issues to respond to. Could I just put one? In addition, the recently published World Development Report put great emphasis on the disempowering effect of poverty. There are, in fact, three key challenges, and one of them is the issue of empowering people. And my question is, why doesn't the World Bank really empower poor people by explaining and educating them to the rights they have, economic, social, and cultural rights, to health, to education, to food, and adopt a rights-based approach. You're almost there. Why not use the language?
Well, Madam Chairperson and President Havel, let me thank you both for bringing us together today, and thank you for the 5 minutes to respond to the many assertions that have been made about the institution. I have a long list of them, and I rather think it would be difficult to give rebuttals on every subject, including my own encounters with President Suharto, what I think is right or wrong about the Chad-Cameroon pipeline, or many of the other issues and assertions that have been made about either our integrity or our effectiveness. I feel a certain sense of obligation to a lot of colleagues of mine to say to you that when we go to work every day, we have a rather different view of the institution. We have 10,000 people from 140 countries, including 1,000 Africans. And our self-image, wrong as Mr. Bellow may think it is that we're actually doing good. We have as our objective to fight poverty with passion. Our people work pretty damn hard. It is central to what we're trying to do. I can have images in my mind of the countries that I visited where not evil has been done, but where good has been done, whether it be on microcredit schemes or environmental programs that have worked, where it be on issues of battered women or of orphans, whether it be on the issue of AIDS in Africa. For us, when we go to work, that's what we think we're doing. We don't think that we have been responsible for 3 billion people in the world living under $2 a day. We are, after all, a development institution, not a world government. But what I can say to you is that, at least in recent years, what we have recognized is that the bank cannot do it alone. We actually believe that civil society cannot do it alone. And that we think to meet the challenge of poverty, which to us is the prevailing challenge of our time, it's necessary to have dialogue and partnership in trying to address these issues. I welcome the debate today. I welcome Mr. Bellow's suggestion that we should have a real dialogue and a real debate. And I'm anxious to have whatever arguments, however vigorously put they may be, to try and address the issues together. We're keen to do that. We have tried to do that. We have tried to reach out. We are trying to reach out. But I have to say to you that there are images of our institution which make dialogue rather difficult. Images that have been put to you today. Simple, clear, aggressive, and destructive. I don't believe that we're that sort of institution. I don't believe that I'm working in the institution for that reason. I believe, actually, that I'm working to try and contribute to a better world. And I believe that my colleagues feel the same way. And I feel it necessary to say to you on their behalf that you should not regard us as a black and evil force. Maybe we've got things wrong. I'm sure we have in many cases. But please understand that the actions which we're taking are designed to try and deal with the fundamental issues of poverty and equity. We know more than anybody that in the next 25 years, 2 billion more people will be added to our planet, from 6 to 8 billion, all but a few million going to developing countries. Our attempts are to try and reach out and to try and work together. And I simply say to you that the basis on which we're doing it may not be, as Mary Robin describes, in terms of a rights-based approach, although we could indeed adopt a rights-based approach. We are taking the assumption that the rights are there and we're trying to give effect to them. Amartya Sen calls them freedoms. You call them rights. We call them a pragmatic attempt to try and protect and get for people the rights that you espouse so effectively. And we do not believe that just the assertion of the signatory of the human rights undertakings is going to be enough to give weight to what the people really need. So our approach is pragmatic, it is open, and I just simply want to say to you that our objectives are very similar to the objectives of the people in the streets. We're ready for the dialogue, we're anxious for the dialogue, but let it be a dialogue of listening and not just of talking. Thank you.
We're having different views and perspectives, as I hoped we would, on this panel. And I now turn to my far left, I enjoy saying that, to my far left, to invite George Soros to make a contribution and respond to some of the things he's heard. But again, I'd like to put a question to him. I've heard you say that we don't have an appropriate international mechanism for regulating the global financial markets. And you've noted that the IMF and the World Bank were created for a different world, a world in which there weren't the same huge capital movements. But clearly you're somebody who has benefited from these capital movements and benefited considerably. Assuming that a new regulatory mechanism simply can't be created overnight, shouldn't you and others in the financial sector be taking the lead in finding a short-term solution that assumes a responsibility? It's, if you like, a dimension of the global compact that Secretary General Kofi Annan has sought to have corporations take on board. I'd like to hear your views on that and also any response you may wish to make to the debate. Thank you.
Well, I should certainly like to take the lead in addressing the shortfalls of the global capitalist system. But I don't think that as a financial participant we can actually change it, because we play by the rules that are there. And I think we need to change the rules. And I think that some of the things that are wrong with the system have been very well stated here today. This is a very good real beginning to a dialogue, because deficiencies have been well stated. What I worry about is that the representatives of civil society, and I consider myself one of those representatives, so far have put forward the wrong remedy, which is to abolish the international financial institutions. That is a tragic mistake. I think that we need to reform them, we need to strengthen them, we have to give them more resources to do the job we want them to do. And I think Anne put her finger on it, that it isn't the institutions themselves that are at fault, but the governments that control the institutions. So I think that civil society ought to address itself to its governments to put up more resources and to exercise less political control over these institutions. I think that the World Bank has as its mission the alleviation of poverty. It is an institution that wants to change and adapt itself to changing conditions. And I think Jim Wolfensohn has been a leader in this respect. But it is constrained by the way it is constructed, because it is an organization that is serving the governments. The shareholders decide what loans to make. The World Bank can only make loans that are guaranteed by
the recipient governments, and therefore it is very often doing what Mr. Bellow said, propping up authoritarian or dictatorial regimes. Now, there is a way to develop new mechanisms. The World Bank has, for instance, trust funds, where it has more discretion over the funds. It has its own funds that it can distribute. And from my work a number of East European countries, I have seen that the grants that the World Bank makes can be very effective, but its resources are very limited. Now, arguing for abolition of these institutions puts the NGOs which are doing it on the same in the same camp as the U.S. Congress, which is refusing to provide funds. It's a very strange situation and a tragic situation that people who want to alleviate poverty should be lined up with others who want to rely purely on market forces. So I think that we somehow have to redirect civil society to be more constructive and to put pressure on their own governments to put up the money that is needed, for instance, for debt relief. It's the U.S. Congress that has refused to provide the funds that would make debt relief possible. That's where the pressure needs to be applied. Now, I think Jim Wolfensohn can't argue for removing governmental controls because, as I think Anne correctly said, he is a civil servant, an international civil servant, who is working for the shareholders of the World Bank, which are governments. But I think we as civil society, we can say that there ought to be more funds available for trust funds like the one on combating AIDS. I have been involved in fighting tuberculosis, particularly drug-resistant tuberculosis, in the former Soviet Union. And there is now a loan that the World Bank is going to make to fight it. But I don't think that the loan mechanism is actually the right mechanism, because Russia is willing to take a loan, but Kazakhstan is not, and tuberculosis is a global problem. It has to be. South Africa also has a serious tuberculosis problem. It needs to be fought globally, and the governments ought to contribute the funds that make it possible, and it ought not to be in the form of loans. So my appeal would be to redirect the protest into a constructive channel, and let's reform and strengthen the international institutions.
Thank you. I now turn to the last panelist for this opening round, and Horst Köhler, new managing director of the International Monetary Fund. You're in your honeymoon period. Can you share with us some of your honeymoon dreams? In particular, what are your thoughts on the heavily indebted poor country initiative, the HIPIC initiative?
Thank you, Mrs. Chairperson. Yes, it's right. I may be still in the honeymoon, but I can tell you it's a tough honeymoon. And at the end of this honeymoon, I still hope that you will give me the benefit of the doubt. I would also like, before I give a comment to all the questions which came up, first thank President Havel that he organized that, because it's not just that we here come together with NGOs. I see it also, President, in the context that you had been one of the inspirers who gave us a lot to overcome a dictatorship of communism. And I do think that even maybe in the Czech Republic, in other countries, so-called transition countries, people may feel today that the market economy and democracy is not perfect. And they feel it partly very strongly. But on the other hand, I have the strong feeling that the big, big majority of the people feel also they never would like to go back to a dictatorship, to an authoritarian regime, and that the democracy and market-oriented economic policies at the end are a good approach to strive for a better world. Well, what did I do when I came in this office 4 months ago? I ordered to myself, and it's also not easy, to listen. And I traveled to Latin America, I traveled to Asia, I traveled to Africa. And I talked there to the leaders, but I also talked there to business people and particularly to people of the civil society. And I came back totally encouraged that it's worth to work for a better world. Why? I saw no leader, for instance in Africa, who was not aware of his own responsibility, of the responsibility of the country, the elites there, for their own homemade problems. And Trevor Manuel is one of these leaders who knows exactly what is right for his country. He doesn't need to be lectured by us, by the Western world, by the IMF or who else. They know what to do, and they are aware of that, and they want to tackle their own issues. I feel this is very encouraging. They ask for support, and that's the issue at stake, but they don't ask just for charity. A second point of this visit coming back and the conclusion was, I must be honest, I had to listen to a lot of critical comments about the role of the IMF. And one lady in a discussion even said, for me, the IMF, at the beginning of the discussion, she said, for me, the IMF stands for SAD. SAD means secretive, arrogant, dominant. At the end of the discussion, she said, now I feel it's no longer sad. Because I know you. She told me, I know now you have also a heart. She felt this German new managing director must be someone who has no heart. I have a heart, but I have also to use my brain to find solutions. So I came back encouraged because also the people in the civil society in Africa, they didn't ask for abolishment of the fund. They asked for support by the fund and the World Bank. That was their voice. So they asked for change and they asked for better support, but not for abolishment of the institutions. So how do I see the situation? We really have to face a new situation. It is not absolutely new in terms of historical experience, but in terms of depth and speed, globalization. What I have heard from the leaders in the developing world, they are aware of the opportunities of this globalization and their own responsibility to get the opportunities work, but also they are aware of the risks and problems and downside things of the globalization. And these leaders ask for, let us work together to make the potential alive for the people. And this means also on this basis, fight poverty within an environment of globalized economic trade and exchange. So that's exactly my own position. I do think we have to bring forward the potential, the opportunities of globalization and try to contain the risks and the problems. And here I see really the fund in a kind of front line together with the World Bank. I feel myself as being part, hopefully an active part, of the workforce to make globalization work for the benefit of all. For the benefit of all, and that means all who want to exchange, want to be open, should have access to the opportunities. And that is my philosophy, and that means also that I see a need for a change in the fund which goes beyond the change which has already been initiated since some years. I think it is not fair to judge even G7, that they are only stupid and are using the IMF and the World Bank only for their instruments. Don't underestimate even the capability of G7 authorities to listen, to learn and draw conclusions. So my advice is, let us take conclusions out of experience and make it better for the future. My vision for the fund is, be helpful and don't disengage from the poor. Stay even stronger engaged with the poor. But my approach is, give them the feeling for help for self-help, because that at the end will work, or will only work. And this also helps them to preserve their own identity, their culture, their pride to their own history, traditions and culture. A very important point, which is my, guiding line. Last point, Mrs. Chairperson, in this first round, debt. It seems to me, so first I should say, I am committed to work that the HIPIC initiative becomes a full success. And therefore, together with Jim Wolfenson, we are working that we, up to the end of this year, bring 20 countries to the so-called decision point, which triggers debt relief. But I also am eager to add to this. Please don't think debt relief and debt cancellation is a quick fix for solving the problems of the poverty. Because nowhere there is a quick fix. No one of us, and even not the NGOs, have the wisdom for everything. So we have to look, what is the approach to solve poverty? And debt relief is one element. A second element is still and strongly to do everything for strong, sustained growth in the world economy and access for the poor countries to this growth. And this means for me, particularly, the rich countries, the developed countries, have to open their markets, that the poor countries, the emerging market countries, have a better chance to get access to wealth, to prosperity, jobs and income. And the third point is also right. We should not forget it. The rich world has promised since decades official development aid in the amount of 0.7% of GNP. The ratio now stands with 0.23 or something. If the rich world would deliver on their promises, I think we could be a much bigger step forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kohler. Enjoy your honeymoon. I have been asked just for a brief response to one or two points by Anne Pettifor, and then I'm going to open to the floor because time is passing, and I'm sure there are some of you at the floor. I'll go to the floor and then come back to you. But Anne, you just wanted very specific points, please.
I just want to say that we did not call for the abolition of the bank and the fund, and we do not do that. We recognise the importance of the rich countries getting together multilaterally to mobilise resources for the poor countries. What we are against is the bank and the fund being used as institutions to apply a drug. And the drug is force open your capital markets. Now, I thought Trevor Manuel put his finger on the pulse when he said, we want capital markets, we want access to capital markets, but we have low savings. Our transfers are huge, dividend flows and debt service payments. In other words, poor countries are forced, because they are highly indebted, to open up their capital and trade markets, while rich countries, as Mr. Kohler has just said, keep their markets closed. And the IMF and the World Bank are the instruments for making the thing about which Trevor Manuel is complaining. That is what we are against, and that is what has to end. Thank you.
I don't agree with that. I don't agree.
Pane prezidente Havle, dámy a pánové. Paní Anne Pettifor sdělila, kdo chybí na pódiu, že jsou tam zástupci Mezinárodního měnového fondu, Světové banky, finančních institucí a občanských iniciativ. Od občanských iniciativ jsem jenom zatím slyšel v podstatě jednotný názor na kritiku zcela zásadní a velice tvrdou na Mezinárodní měnový fond a funkci Světové banky. Já jako zástupce jiné občanské iniciativy, která se jmenuje Česká iniciativa, myslím, že pan prezident ji dobře zná, vystoupili jsme na podporu jeho volby několikrát od roku 1990. Velice intenzivně okolo sebe sdružují mnohé mladé lidi v České republice. Já za účastníky České iniciativy chci vyjádřit, že nesouhlasím ani s jedním slovem paní Kateřiny Liškové, ani s jedním názorem, který byl pronesen, a přesto jsem rád, že tady mohl být pronesen. Nicméně, vážení zástupci Mezinárodního měnového fondu, jsme velice rádi, že jste k nám přijeli. Zabýváme se bretonskými institucemi, zabýváme se jejich vývojem, máme kolem sebe mladé lidi, kteří jsou velice rádi. Samozřejmě i my nesouhlasíme s některými věcmi, které se dějou, financování pana Jelcina, financování zbrojení. To jsou věci, které musí být změněny. Nicméně zcela zásadně nesouhlasíme s kraválem, který je dělán kolem tohoto zasedání. A já vás jenom prosím, až budete jednat v kongresovém centru a bude kolem vás tisíc lidí křičet, ať se zrušíte, nedělejte to. Jsou tady jiní tisíce lidí, kteří vám fandí, kteří vám drží palce, a jsou to občané České republiky. Děkuji.
Going to take more contributions from the floor. If you could please identify yourself and if you represent an organization, and please try to either ask a question or make a very brief point. There was a hand showing on this side, and then a gentleman over there, and then at the back. Yep, sorry. Yes. All right, you've got the mic, but the next one, you're next. Please go ahead.
Děkuji za udělení slova. Ohnutek, nové hnutí. Já si myslím, že tady ještě nepadlo vůbec nic o tom, že všechno bohatství, co máme, je bohatství z přírody. A žijeme už ve situaci, ve vývoji překročení mezí. Viz Meadows, studie o stavu světa, překročení mezí. Jediné řešení, které nám zbývá, je respektování, čili diktatura přírody, uskutečňovaná prostřednictvím demokracie moudrých občanů. Hospodářský systém je třeba změnit na systém řízený, pružný systém, globálně lokální, limitní hospodářství kombinovaný s místní soběstačností. Trh jako takový lze použít ovšem jenom v krátkodobých, řekl bych, cyklech na vyrovnání určitých hospodářských situací. To je zhruba o principu všechno.
Thank you. I think you brought in a dimension that hadn't come out as yet in the debate. Could we have a microphone here to this gentleman?
Thank you, Mrs. Chairman. I am Willy Thijs, Secretary General of World Confederation of Labour International Trade Unions, representing 26 million workers in the world. Independent and democratic unions belong to the civil society too. I believe for us the two priorities, to eliminate the poverty and to cancel all the debt, private and public, of the poorest country is very important. And we wait from IMF and World Bank that they stop to speak and begin to act. But I wish now to speak about employment and labor market. The international trade union movement welcomes the focus on poverty alleviation. However, we believe that this will not be a reality unless the World Bank and the IMF really change their policy with regards to the role of trade unions, labor markets, employment generation, and social safety nets. The macroeconomic reforms proposed by the Bretton Woods institution must promote full and productive employment and provide adequate safety nets. One cannot only keep on privatizing to make macroeconomic figures look good without taking into consideration the social impact of privatization. Furthermore, World Bank and IMF policies have in the past neglected social safety nets. like unemployment benefits, pensions and maternity benefits. Oh, and when all these factors will be taken into consideration in the poverty alleviation strategy of the World Bank and the IMF? It was my question. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a man here with a blue shirt. I'm actually getting anxiously... Look, oh, yes, there's a woman, yes. Before the man in the blue shirt, could we have this woman down there? Yes, thank you. There has to be some discrimination in a positive way. He'll come back to you. The woman over there, and then you. Please, the woman first. Thank you. I'm in a position to strike a blow for equality.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Robinson. Mrs. Robinson, my name is Winnie Bukhari, and I'm from Indonesia. I represent the International NGO Forum on Indonesian Development. On behalf of the Indonesian, I would really like to thank Walden Bello to put forward the case of the Indonesian situations. And my question is to Mr. Wolfensohn. As you know very well, Mr. Wolfensohn, that the total external debt of Indonesia actually assumes about 96% of our total GDP. And more than 50% of our state budget has been used for servicing the debt, and more is going to be used for servicing the debt. And yet, we have been declined on the excess of debt relief or debt reductions, or let alone debt cancellations. We have been talking back and forth to your staff in Indonesia, and what they said, in no way, don't ever dream to get any cancellation from us. I would like to hear your response, because without serious debt reduction initiative, Indonesia is facing and is currently facing the loss of generation. I hope you understand what it means. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to give Jim Wolfensohn an immediate opportunity to respond to that question, and then I'll come to the gentleman in the blue shirt. But Mr. Jim Wolfensohn.
Yeah, I had a meeting yesterday with your new finance minister on exactly this issue of debt. The one thing which occurred on the debt relief initiative, which seems to have been forgotten, is that we invented this 3 years ago to try and get, for the first time in history, a debt relief going from the international institutions to countries. And with great difficulty, we were able to argue through that there were certain guidelines that we could use for what are the poor countries, which are well known, I'm sure, to Ann Pettifor. Since that time, many countries have come and said we need to have debt forgiven. But we have not been able to get our board or the directors of representing the countries to agree to extend debt forgiveness to everybody. And so at this current moment, I'd have to back up my colleagues in the office and say, I do not see any immediate prospect of debt forgiveness in Indonesia. What I do see is an opportunity to try and work together on a bilateral basis to see if we can bring the total amount of debt down and try and help Indonesia in a moment of very great need. I think that you have a very great need, but I think the international community generally is going to say for countries like Indonesia that you have debts, you need to repay them, because otherwise the whole of the global system collapses. But maybe that will change in a few years, but as of this moment, I think what my colleagues have told you is right.
Mr. President, distinguished members of the panel, my name is Ricardo Navarro, and I am the chairman of Friends of the Earth International. We're a federation of environmental groups in 68 nations with more than 1 million people membership. Mr. Wolfensohn, I am sure you know the many problems that many of the projects that the World Bank has financed have generated. For example, with the dams, large dams, more than 10 million people have been displaced out of their homes. I remember the Chitsoy Dam in Guatemala. 400 people were killed in order to build that dam. I am sure the World Bank did not order that killing, but the World Bank was supporting economically the military government that was doing the killing. So the World Bank shares some responsibility for that, the IMF also. But not only that, the World Bank has become the biggest financer of climate change by all this oil mining, for example. And is generating an economic system where most of the profits get concentrated in very few hands, and all the costs are distributed democratically. The South, for example, is experiencing the problems of climate change. Some people in the northern countries particularly get the benefits out of petroleum consumption. But a lot of people in the South suffer the consequences of hurricanes like Mitch in Central America that took the lives of 12,000 people. Mads in Venezuela took the lives of 25,000 people. By that, an ecological debt has been generated that the North owes to the South. By the North, I mean most of the countries of the North plus middle and higher classes in the South. Mr. Wolfenson, don't you think it's time that the World Bank acknowledges that ecological debt that the World Bank, as such, has been also financing? I have seen you talking about economic debt, for good or for bad. Don't you think it's time also to consider the ecological debt, to find ways of paying that debt, to find ways of recovering all that damage generated? Thank you.
It wasn't part of my contract here today that I had to answer questions. But I think I would like to respond to what you said about large dams, because what I was indicating at the beginning is that we can shape issues by having the right policies. And we now, I think, have made considerable progress through the World Commission on Dams, chaired by Minister Kader Azmal, Minister of Education of South Africa. The report of that commission adopts a rights-based approach to the issue and has been the result of an enormous consultation. We can learn from that approach, and I think we can apply it in other areas. Yeah. Jim Wolfenson also wants to answer.
May I just say that we were responsible for setting up the commission. and I don't think that should be forgotten. It is simply that when I came in and there were a lot of issues about dams, I said, let's set up an independent commission to take a look at the dams completely. And we talked Kader Azmal into taking it on. And it was very difficult to put it together. But we've financed it. It is totally independent. And we're dealing with it. Second thing I just want to say in terms of environment. I was in Stockholm 25 years ago. The environment is not something new to me. I was there at the first global conference, and I care a lot about it. And in fact, on climate change, we are the largest factor in terms of trying to stop some of the pernicious behavior that is going on around the world. So to put us in the box that we're the people who are in fact causing climate change is just simply wrong.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to take one more question from this side, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to close the...
Tomáš Tožička, milostivé léto 2000, Česká republika, Jubilee 2000, Czech Republic. Budu mluvit česky. Když je v naší zemi, a myslím si, že i ve většině zemí zástupců, kteří jsou na panelu, když je někdo zadlužen v naší zemi, tak... jeho základní lidské potřeby, právo na vzdělání, právo na přežití, je nadřazeno splácení dluhů. Tohle právo platí v Evropě už přes 500 let a bohužel na mezinárodní úrovni nic podobného neplatí. Ta situace, kdy dluhy řeší věřitele, například v pařížském nebo v londýnském klubu, kde hrají roli soudců i advokátů, roli nezávislých expertů. Ta situace je podle našeho názoru neudržitelná, nelegitimní a kdyby se dělala na národní úrovni, tak by byla označena minimálně za mafiánskou. Takže v současné chvíli se naskýtá otázka, která už je diskutována i na mezinárodní úrovni, ale zatím ne dost široce, zda není potřeba vytvořit jakési nezávislé těleso, které by bylo schopné řešit provádět nějaký arbitrážní proces mezi věřiteli a dlužníky tak, aby, což by zároveň zvedlo odpovědnost jak věřitelů, tak dlužníků s tím, že tenhle arbitrážní proces bude konečné slovo k řešení dluhu. A já bych chtěl říct, že samozřejmě milostivé léto nevěří, že odpuštění dluhu vyřeší všechny problémy. Ani ne tak, jako byly řešeny právě v zemi pana Kellera v Německu, kde velké oddlužení právě pomohlo tomu, aby Evropa dokázala řešit tu poválečnou situaci. Děkuji.
I missed one hand here, I think, and I just take a last person. Yes, please, here. And then I know that Katarina wants to say a last word. And
thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Oh, I'm Silishevo from Zambia. I come from the United Church of Zambia. I have one question for Mr. Kola. I welcome and appreciate the possibility that he sees in the West opening the market to the developed world. And yet I realize that even if I came open-handed to this market, I wouldn't be considered. And I don't think I would even be welcome. And yet I come from a country with massive untapped natural resources. And the little that we earn as a country is paid to the World Bank and IMF every year and leaves us with very little or nothing for tapping those natural resources. What help, what support would you have for a country like mine? Because further borrowing is not the answer. It means that I have to pay the loan tomorrow. What support and help would you have for a country like mine? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Kohler, I'll allow you to answer that.
Well, the most concrete answer is that we work just in these days and weeks to give Zambia debt relief under the HIPIC initiative. And we want also to work that it is done in a way that it is a debt relief on a sustained path. That's my first answer. The second answer is that, of course, we stand ready with all our technical assistance, advice, also to give some orientation. How could a good policy look like, a good economic policy to explore the potential of the country? At the end, the country itself has to decide on this good policy. So you have to have good governance. You have to have no corruption. I'm sorry that I have to say that, but if we are not going to a good governance, nothing will help, and even not debt relief.
Thank you. I have two panelists, Katarina and Walden Bello, who want. Sorry, I have Katarina and Walden Bello who want to make very short comments, and also the Minister, and then I'm really going to have to close. I see hands, and I'm very sorry, but we have to have our walk together. And Katarina.
Děkuju. Já budu mluvit česky, jednak proto, aby jazyky čeština a angličtina byly trošku vyváženy, a jednak proto, že hlas, na který chce reagovat, zazněl v češtině. Já tedy na tomto panelu reprezentuji ne všechny občanské iniciativy v této zemi, ale radikální odpůrce politiky fondu a banky. Radikální znamená důsledný, nikoli násilný. A už vůbec to neznamená, že děláme v ulicích nebo chceme dělat v ulicích kravál. My pouze chceme využít svoje právo, které nám garantuje ústava a mezinárodní právní úmluvy, abychom vyjádřili svůj názor. Bohužel ve vyjádření tohoto názoru je nám bráněno. Naše demonstrace a pochody jsou zakazovány. Lidé z ciziny, kteří se chtějí účastnit protestů, nejsou vpouštěni přes naše hranice. My jsme přesto přesvědčeni, že nám to právo vyjádřit názor náleží. A pokud bychom ho nemohli uplatnit, potom nemá smysl hovořit o občanské společnosti. Děkuji.
Thank you, Katarina, and indeed thank you for your courage for coming to participate on this panel today. I'd now like to call on Walden Bello briefly.
Yes, I would just like to express here, Madam Chairman, my disquiet at the fact that we came here expecting a hard discussion on facts, and yet what we have gotten was Mr. Wolfensohn saying that he feels good going to work for the World Bank, and Mr. Kohler saying that he has a heart too. Now, the thing is that there are all these really major issues on which, you know, people are here. Like, for instance, Mr. Kohler, what are you doing about giving developing countries more power in the board by diluting the tremendous power of the U.S. and the EU? For instance, you talk about good governance. How do we start ending this medieval non-transparent practice that says that a European must always have the IMF and an American must always have the World Bank? I mean, if Mr. Wolfensohn had remained Australian, he would never have become a head of the World Bank.
Maybe I should have.
Mr. Wolfensohn, I mean, the hard questions, come on. Why did you not stand by Joseph Stiglitz when he was forced out of the World Bank? Or Mr. Ravi Kanpur over that World Development Report?
I think you've put questions. I want to give Mr. Kohler a chance.
Yes,
to
Mrs. Robinson, this is precisely what this whole debate is about. Yeah. Hard questions, hard answers.
Mr. Kohler. Yeah.
I think I gave an answer, and this answer was that the IMF is in a process of change based on drawing conclusions out of experience and maybe even mistakes. But I also would like to say just posing questions on the table is not enough. We have really to find answers, and answers are always to be given with some responsibility, because no one has a quick fix, even not Mr. Bellow has a quick fix. And if you would like to see, for instance, Indonesian managing director, fight for it. I expect then maybe you have the interest that an Indonesian managing director is working for the Indonesian interest. I must say what I am working for. That is that I feel myself obliged to work for the international common good. And this is particularly also to do something now and concentrate on a global economy which enables the poor to get out of this mess with international support, but also with self-responsibility.
That is a rhetorical answer, not an answer to pointed questions we ask you. Okay. Answer the question.
Okay. I think that President Havel, in his great wisdom, knew that we would not answer all the hard questions, or maybe even begin the answers to the hard questions in the short period that we had at our disposal. And so he very wisely suggested that we would come for a walk. And I have no doubt that during that walk we will address those hard questions and perhaps advance them. I come back to something I raised at the beginning. I have a sense, moderating this panel, that each of the participants has shown a passion about what they have said, and I welcome that. We've had different viewpoints and perspectives, but there has been a passionate sense of commitment and belief. I really do feel myself with passion that it will make a difference when we bring more close together the different rules of the road that we have in relation to economic globalization and its impact. We heard from the floor about environment. We heard about labor concerns and standards. Finance ministers, with respect, don't know what's in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but they should, because their policies deeply affect what happens. And so perhaps we can take from this session much to think about. And I simply end by expressing appreciation to each of the panelists, and indeed to you, the audience, and I regret that I couldn't take all the hands that were showing. But I had been somewhat apprehensive about moderating this particular debate, because it's the first time I've done something like this. But it's also my first visit to Prague. I will combine the two in a sense of, I think it has been a positive experience. Prague is a city with a long history of creating space for dialogue out of difficulty, out of difference, out of confrontation, out of the pain of having views repressed. We've heard pain expressed today, and I think it's very good that this space opened up in Prague. I hope it will continue to be open. I hope we can build on it. I hope we find ways of building on it. And I end again by thanking President Havel for his initiative and looking forward to the walk. Thank you very much.
Já bych především chtěl poděkovat Mary Robinsonové za to, jak se zhostila své premiérové role moderátorky takovéhoto typu rozpravy. Dále bych chtěl poděkovat všem panelistům i vám všem, kteří jste přišli, nejen za to, že jste se účastnili debaty, že jste mluvili otevřeně, ale i za to, že jste byli ochotni jeden druhému naslouchat. Jsem tím velmi dojat a věřím, že to je začátek jakéhosi dialogu, který neskončí v tuto chvíli, ale bude permanentní a všudy přítomný. Jsme odsouzeni žít všichni na této planetě, spolu nemůžeme nikam emigrovat, musíme hledat v rozhovoru způsoby, jak co nejlépe a co nejspravedlivěji soužít na této planetě. Já vás teď zvu do zahrady Pražského hradu k procházce. Věřím, že i při té procházce ti z vás, kteří budou chtít, budou pokračovat v rozhovoru. Je tam pro vás na vaši počest připraveno několik plastik zdobících tuto zahradu, bude tam též hudba a též přiměřené občerstvení. Zvu vás srdečně ven.